You're listening to the Food Talk Show. Hi there, my name is Sue Nelson, and for the next hour we will be talking about all things food. I'm joined by my fellow presenter, Ollie Lloyd of Great British Chefs. Hello, Ollie. You're just fresh from lunch.
Fresh from a nice, spicy lunch.
As usual. Not going to go anywhere near him. Lots of smells going on there. I'm joined by our guest today, Ben Jackson of Capsicana. I think I've got that right.
You have indeed.
I have got that right. And the fabulous Carolyn Steele, who is author of Hungry City. Can't wait to talk to her because I just love to hear everything about food and history and how cities work when it comes to just the logistics of food. So we'll be having a good old chat about that. Just to start off, Ben, you've bought loads of things for us to taste, which we always like in the studio.
I have. I've bought our four cooking sauces that were all based on Latin American recipes. Unfortunately, I didn't have time to cook anything with them, so we're just going to have to try the sauce. I did bring some crisps.
I think that's a slightly poor effort there, Ben. You could have cooked us up a nice.
And you haven't had lunch.
Yeah, Carolyn hasn't had lunch. She'd have appreciated that if you'd have whizzed up a quick.
I would.
Yeah, well done. So just a little bit about you. All of these are sort of South American influenced. What's your link with South America?
Well, I was sort of explaining to Carolyn before we started that...
The thing is, this is a radio show and you probably need to do it again.
Oh, I'm going to do it again. No, I was just sort
of... That's a joke, Ben.
Yes. No, that's fine. No, I mean, basically, when I was growing up, my parents divorced when I was very young, so I used to see my dad like once a month. And my dad was always really into cooking. And so I'd sort of see my dad and we would cook together. And in fact, the two things that we did was cooking or playing guitar. So my dad had a particular palate around spicy world foods, not necessarily spicy meat, referring just to chili, but lots of exotic flavours. So we would always cook sort of Indian food or Thai food, Tex-Mex, Mexican, that sort of stuff. So I kind of grew up eating that kind of stuff and really, really having kind of a connection to it because it reminded me of fun time with dad kind of thing.
And was this in this country?
And then he moved out to Texas when I was about 17 or 18. And I was out there with him for about 6 months or 6 to 9 months. And back in the UK, if you went in the supermarkets and bought chilies, you'd get like fresh bird's eye chilies or you get cayenne pepper. And it was always very much, this is something you had to impart heat, not flavour. And then when I went out to Texas, I was just sort of, you know, going around all these various Mexican cantinas, there was all these different varieties of chili that didn't look anything like what you would expect a chili to look like.
I mean, they can be all sizes, can't they, and shapes?
Yeah. Mm. And B didn't taste anything, but they had a flavour profile, which was just completely bizarre. So, you know, you have like anchos, which taste like taste like raisins. And then you'd have, you know, there's a cascabel, they taste a bit like licorice. You get chipotle, everybody's heard of. And there's all these other ones as well. And I just thought it was really interesting.
I mean, we had Pritesh, didn't we, the other week, Ollie, from World of Thing. And he was telling us about all sorts of, you know, flavour profiles that he was trying to mix. I couldn't believe the range of some of them are lemony, for example, aren't they? And others are smoky. And it's really exploring that. And so you got into that.
So that's kind of how I got into it. Well, we had a friend. So we lived north of Dallas in a sort of town called Plano. And we had a friend who was living in Austin and we had some friends in San Antonio. So we used to do these road trips. And one of our mates in Austin, his parents were Mexican. And he was like first generation American. And he'd take us to all these like little backstreet diners and stuff like that. So if you're on the main street, you could like go to Taco Bell and
get ripped off and
have a disastrous experience. Or you could go to these really cool little Mexican cantinas that were literally run by Mexican families. I mean, literally mum and dad would be in the kitchen cooking and the eldest children would be going around the table serving. And then there'd be like a couple of 3 or 4 year olds playing with Tonka toys in the corner. And it was just, you know, great time.
You've got a real theory about the provision of Mexican food in supermarkets, haven't you, Ollie?
Well, I think it's as you say, grossly underrepresented, and I think what's historically been in the supermarkets has been pretty boring, actually.
Just not very good quality either.
No, not authentic.
Yeah, and I suppose actually that's what I mean.
But also, I think the other thing that's very different about Mexican cuisine is there isn't somewhere you can go in the UK to get those ingredients in a shop. So obviously, Chinese, Indian, Thai, all of these are well supported by a whole network of local specialist stores that have all those ingredients. But
like,
if you want,
like Brindisa for Spanish.
Like Brindisa for Spanish. Yeah. So you've got, so there are places like that that will do a particular cuisine like that. But actually, there isn't a whole load of, you know, infrastructure of Asian supermarkets that actually addresses the Latin American range of cuisine.
Well, it has gotten better and changed. I mean, that you can get quite a lot of different, you know, sort of cooking from scratch ingredients items online, like Sous Chef, do loads of stuff. And if you go into Waitrose and those sorts of places, you can get kind of like packets of guajillo or whatever. But yeah, I mean, as a general meal, you're not going to get masa harina in Waitrose or anything like that, you know. So
you decided to take your experience with your good old dad and come up with these. Why sauces, cooking sauces? Was that the bit for you that was... That reminds you of cooking with your dad, the bit that you're missing?
No, when I actually started, I started 8 years ago on a market stall in Hitchin with about £500. And at the time it was cooking from scratch ingredients because I was trying to do, it was about cooking a meal. So it was chilies, it was epazote, it was Mexican oregano, achiote powder, that sort of stuff. And I felt really great because it was like real stuff, you know. But at the same time, what I found was it was really, really difficult for the average person to kind of get into it and really, you know, because it was stuff that would either take a long time to prepare because it was literally, you know, cooking from scratch ingredients, or the other barrier to use was people looking at a chili, liking the smell of it, liking talking about it, but not feeling that they necessarily had knowledge of cooking that sort of stuff. So it was really, the cooking sources was really trying to make it really easy for people.
And trying to bridge that gap between, I know I really like that stuff, I sort of get the ingredients, but I'm really not quite sure what to do.
Exactly. I mean, I think that people tend to have very, very set patterns when they're cooking and preparing meals. And on the one hand, they you know, they will want something that's interesting and different. But on the other hand, they kind of, you know, a lot of people get home from work and they've got 30 minutes to cook their meal. And in that 30 minutes, they have got to have a good outcome. They need to eat, otherwise they've got to do it again. So I think there's a lot of reservation around people trying new things, sort of getting into new things and forming new habits and patterns. So we're just trying to make it really easy for people. That's
So I've got some lovely packets in front of me, ranging from mild to hot. I know which one Ollie's looking at already. do you eat chilies and stuff? Do you?
Oh yes,
you're okay
yes.
with that. You're
I have
for a bit
sort
of a try
limit, as it were. But I can go fairly high. But I'll do anything for good flavour. So I'm
well, good because you're just about to try something. So shall we start from the? I suppose we should start from the mild end, shouldn't we? Really, that would make
that
sense
would make
rather
sense.
Than going the other way.
So we're putting these on the crisp.
You can do whatever you want. I mean, normally Ollie just gets a spoon and digs in, don't he?
Well, yeah, it goes a different way. While you're opening the crisp,
that noise in the background is the crisp being opened. Yep,
it actually happened.
Yeah, it did. I mean, what's interesting about Mexican food, I think, is that it is gaining in popularity in the UK. So we did some recent research about different cuisines that people are cooking. And if you look at the really kind of committed foodie audience, 66% of those people actually say they have cooked Mexican food at home. Mm-hmm. So it is a cuisine that people are now cooking at home. And I think there's been a real growth.
Would that be chili con carne, though? Is that what they...
We haven't dug into the exact dishes, but I think that, you know, knowing this audience, it's actually a range of different dishes.
Yeah.
And it's obviously more popular than some others. It's interesting, more popular than Thai amongst foodies. So I think they are sort of appreciating the flavour profile and some of the stuff that actually can be done with Mexican food. Mm.
Okay, well, I mean, I've been to what's the one with Thomasina Myers?
So that's Oaxaca.
Oaxaca. Mm-hmm. So for me, that's where I sort of go for my Mexican
hit.
You know, hit. But
have you been to Bredos in Clerkenwell?
No.
Very good.
Is that a good one?
There was a great one I went into not so long ago, just over by Old Street, called Santa Remedia.
Yes.
And that was phenomenal.
Yep.
I mean, that was very, very good indeed.
But I think what I think again is interesting is you're starting to get a range of. Well, an appreciation that Mexican food isn't one cuisine.
Yeah.
And that actually there are all these regions. And I think that's what's kind of quite important, that we start to unpack, you know, these enormous countries that actually, I mean, you know, and you're, you know, you've got a Brazilian one here, a Peruvian one there, and a Mexican one there. So we're actually dealing with, you know, I suppose a whole range of different Latin American cuisines rather than just one. So this is beyond Mexico. This is Latin American, isn't it?
You see, that's where my knowledge of South American food isn't brilliant, because I'm just assuming it's all one, you know, homogenous sort of taste mass. But it isn't, is it? It's like Indian food. There's as many different types, I would imagine, as anything.
So there's kind of common ingredient things.
Yeah, sure.
But then there's obviously a lot of variety around them.
Yeah. Well, I've just had a taste of this is the Peruvian chili and lemon mild.
Yeah.
Now that's got Amarillo chilies in. What's the taste profile of Amarillo chilies?
They're quite fruity.
Can I just say that Caroline Steele's just put a thumbs up?
That's fantastic.
In fact, you've got a double.
Can we do
up
high
there.
Five?
Yes.
High five on that one.
I mean, you can cook it for me if you like as well sometime.
But yeah, a slightly fruity chili.
Yeah, I mean, the Amarillo that we use comes from Peru. It's grown, the crop is grown in Peru, and it's processed into a primary mash in Peru. And then we bring it over and we actually finish off. Wow. We actually have all the production over here because we can control it and QA it.
And how are you encouraging people to cook with these sauces? So is it...
That's a really tricky one because... Unfortunately, because of some of the things you were referring to earlier about just what people have seen in retail stores that's, you know, kind of Tex-Mex or Mexican, the most common word that people feel really comfortable with and they really know what they're going to do, they can really see what they're going to do when they get home, is fajitas.
Of course, yeah.
Because it's the most common word.
Kids love it as well.
You say to people fajitas. We have this all the time. I mean, we go to food shows all over the place. We've been in front of about 800,000 consumers this year so far. And if we take this to the people and they say, well, what do I do with it? You say, you can make a quick chicken stir fry thing if you want. And we refer to that as kind of our access recipe. And they start asking those questions. They don't really know what you mean. If you say, "Oh, well, why don't you just try making some
fajitas.
Sort of alternative fajitas with it?"
Yeah.
They go, "Oh, yeah, brilliant."
That's because it's a reference point, I guess.
Exactly. So there's a lot of education that goes into.
But it's also the fact that, look, 60% of the UK can't cook.
Yeah.
And actually, you know...
Don't look at me. I can cook. Before you do that, can you just point me in the direction of the medium one? While we're chatting,
yeah, sure.
So this is chili and honey. Do
Mexican
carry on.
Chili and honey.
No, but I mean, so the fact is that there is a large portion of people who you need to give them, you know, the sort of the one dish that really works. And you know, I mean, Tesco's always talk about the fact there are 8 dishes that people cook. Mm-hmm. That is completely true for about 60% of the population. There's another 15% of the population who can cook 92 plus dishes.
Yeah.
And are kind of the committed foodies and are constantly looking for experimentation. And I think the truth is stuff that is beyond. You know, your kind of regular palate is actually, you know, it doesn't freak them out.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, it's just really, it's a tricky one because we're trying to...
I'm sorry to laugh, Ben.
Did you try this? It's just that
me and Carolyn are tucked into the chili and honey medium, which contains, I think they're called ancho, poblano and chipotle chilies. And she's given you another double thumbs up.
Thank you very much. Karen.
Really delicious.
Can I just point something out?
I like that one a lot.
This is just another thing around education and how people sort of interact with packaging and stuff. It says made with ancho poblano chilies. An ancho chili is a dried poblano chili.
Ah.
They're not called ancho poblanos.
Ah,
but if we just, when we were testing this out, if we just put ancho on the front, people thought it was had anchovies in it.
Ah.
So it's really interesting kind of
figuring out. What do you think of that, Ollie? You like your Mexican
food. I think
it's
delicious.
We got a great taste award for that.
Yeah, I can see why.
I'm really interested in this thing. I mean, the British relationship with food. I mean, we've always had a very international cuisine. I mean, you know, the Romans came here and they imported wine and olive oil and stuff. So we've been eating, you know...
And drinking.
Foreign stuff and drinking for a long time. And that's really interesting. And I think, you know, if you relate the sort of the way we're now learning to eat all sorts of foods like Mexican and Spanish and so on. It actually comes from, the first thing is that people come here and they start cooking it in restaurants and we get used to eating it in restaurants.
Yep.
And then that happened with Chinese and it happened with Indian.
Yep.
And that might go on for two generations or something. And then eventually it becomes familiar enough that people then have the confidence to think, okay, maybe I'll give it a go at home.
Yep.
And that's a sort of progression. You know, so I mean, in fact, Oaxaca may well have been part of that.
Because I call that domesticating. In the end, people domesticate it for themselves, don't they? Yeah. They bring it into the home and they work out how to use it.
I think some of the things that accelerate this process is obviously the availability and ease of access for travel, and also internet. You know, kind of. I mean, if you go on Instagram, or Pinterest, it's just awash with people doing various different quesadillas or whatever it might be.
I've just tasted you've got to try this one, Caroline. I've just tasted the Brazilian chili and coconut. I like coconut as a, you know, as a texture, actually. Cool. but as an ingredient, some people don't. Now, you said that's hot and I'm a little bit slightly frightened of chilies, but actually that's fine for me.
Okay.
But the chilies didn't come until very late on.
Got ginger in it. So the chilies and the ginger interact together and give this warmer.
That's not hot enough for you, is it?
That's very nice.
Warmer sort of sensation.
But it's a big flavour, and that's what you're talking about. Just to pick up on your point about travel. So in the recent research we did, we mapped travel, so what destinations you visited, as well as what cuisines you're cooking at home, what ethnicity you are, what restaurants you visit, what takeaways you do. So we can basically... there isn't a word for it, but triangulate, so to speak, around those data points. Mm. What's interesting is if you look at the percentage of people who have been to a destination and then cook that food, there's a massive increase, which is not, you know, it's not rocket science, but it's nice to be able to prove the point.
But there's a huge correlation.
There's a huge correlation. So if you look at it, so 63% of committed foodies cook Thai food. It increases to 77% if you've been to Thailand.
Mm. Wow.
Right, so actually, so the interesting thing about Mexico, I think, is only 16% of committed foodies have visited Mexico on holiday. Mm-hmm. So actually it's still quite a nascent destination, but it's rapidly growing in interest and because it does have such an exciting food culture. So I think you've got those sort of things going, which is there's sort of a tipping point where enough people have visited a destination, then you start to get the ingredients, then you start to get all the sort of the restaurants and everything else. So it kind of plays backwards and forwards.
Yeah, well, we did some primary research that said that people were interested in eating more, you know, discovering more from the region. And like you were to your point earlier on about a lot of people just perhaps think it's like a homogenized place food wise. And in our primary research, a high number of people were saying we specifically want to see great. I mean, if it's got to be great tasting, that's just full stop, right?
That's a given, though, isn't
exactly,
it?
Exactly. But they specifically wanted to see interesting flavours from places like Brazil, and they were naming places like Brazil, Peru, and all these sorts of things, which was great for us because I felt that for a long, long time, you know. Mm. You know, we're starting to see real evidence.
Well, that Brazilian chili and coconut, I've got a nice warm feeling still with that.
Yeah, I'm tingling.
But in a nice huggy way, not in a killing me way.
This is based on a Brazilian dish called moqueca, which is originally from the southwest. So there are two versions of it. One's sort of very mild and doesn't have any coconut in it. And then this version is based on the Bayan version. And it's just phenomenal with any firm fish. I did scallops and king prawns. Friday. It was.
Didn't bring any though, did you, Ben?
No. Sorry.
You can't have.
Well, next time, guys.
Okay. Well, I'm pretty impressed. I mean, especially as one's got a great taste award, you know that it's all good stuff, isn't it?
No, it's great. It's great. I think it's also the truth of the matter is with the, you know, there's going to be a group of people who will cook these kind of combinations from scratch. But in the same way that foodies use pre-made curry pastes, they use, you know, pre-made ketchups, some make their own. The fact is you've got to meet both ends of the market, which is you've got to give them the facility to make a quick and easy version. But ultimately there will be times when having had that, you'll be like, oh, that's a really good, we're doing a dinner party, let's cook it from scratch, let's find a recipe and recreate it. And that's in some ways, that's where I think also you have it working both ways.
So Ben, if anybody wants to buy some of these lovely sauces, they can go onto your website, can't they? Capsicana.co.uk, which is pretty phonetic, isn't it? Capsicana. Mm-hmm. And I presume they can also find out there where you distribute your products.
We are in Sainsbury's, Waitrose and Whole Foods.
Sainsbury's, Waitrose and Whole Foods. I'm not even going to bother going on the website. I'm going to pop into Sainsbury's.
That's tonight's dinner sauce.
That is tonight's dinner sauce. A Brazilian chili and coconut for me. So thank you very much for joining us.
No problem.
Good taste, I think. I think Carolyn's got her eye on nicking one of those packets to take them home. We're going to have a little break now. I've got a little pre-recording that I did while I was at Speciality and Fine Food Fair with the Cold Group, who made some natural spritz. Drink again, you see.
There we go.
And I'm going to speak to Tori, so we'll come back to you in a minute. Well, for some reason, all the producers on the Food Talk show have lined me up with alcohol first thing in the morning when they could have actually done it, you know, in the afternoon. And I'm joined by Sharon, one of our producers. Sharon, you're OK with gin and vodka, aren't you?
Oh, my favourites, yes, definitely, especially gin. Gin I'm a bit partial to.
Oh, there you go. So we're joined by Tori. And I've seen this brand wandering around at Speciality and Fine Food Fair, and it's called Kalosa Spritz, and that's spelt K-A-L-O-S-A. And beautiful colours there. And we've got pink grapefruit with crisp cranberries and vodka, and another bottle, which is elderflower, which I love elderflower. Elderflower with crisp apples, a dash of lemon and gin. So why have you started making this, Tori? You know, bearing in mind there is so much gin and vodka brands around at the moment, what's different about this?
So we've seen a real movement towards people wanting healthier drinks, drinking less alcohol as well. People are drinking less but better quality. Real move towards premiumization. So we sort of thought, well, how can we sort of, you know, create something along these trends, you know, something that people are going to want to drink now and in the future. And so we came up with Kalosa Spritz, which is... It's 100% natural. It's only 99 calories. It's totally on trend. Obviously, the rise of Aperol Spritz as well. Spritz products are very popular at the moment. So we just sort of tried to combine all these trends and put it into one drink. And the result is a delicious and light, refreshing Spritz product, which has had fantastic feedback.
So while I'm talking, Sharon's just going to tuck into a bit of elderflower and gin and pink grapefruit vodka. The other thing that I think is a lot of wine now is become incredibly strong, and we're talking about 14% proof. It's really far too strong, I think, and I think the industry needs to do something about it. And I do think there are a whole lot of people who would like to sit at lunchtime having a barbecue, whereas if you start whacking the old wine at that point, it's disastrous, isn't it?
No, completely. I completely agree with that. And, you know, I mean, people really are wanting lower ABV options as well. And this is only 4%. And it still gives you that little sort of alcoholic treat, but it's not, you know, it's not a full-on spirit or, you know, high ABV wine. And so it's, you can just drink it when it's hot on a hot day, or, you know, you just want something lighter. Maybe you're driving and you can only have one drink. And this, you know, keeps you sort of below that limit and, you know, gives you that little kick, but without... the sort of full-on ABV strength. So,
well, I'm going to ask Sharon, our gin expert here. Have you had a little taste already?
I have. I've just tasted the elderflower, and it is lovely. I can imagine on a hot summer's day in a barbecue, it is so summery. It's lovely. I really, really like that. And this is really sweet. It's quite nice as well. I'm not normally a lover of pink grapefruit, but...
She's just having a slurp here.
That is really nice, but I'm elderflower, sorry.
I've noticed you've just poured yourself some. Is there any chance you could pour me some?
Yes.
She's only done her own. That's not very nice, is it? As a producer on the Food Talk show, I would say that wasn't a very good career move, Sharon.
sorry.
Right, so I'm just going to have a drink of this pink grapefruit. I do like grapefruit, and there's some very nice grapefruit gins around at the moment as well. So why elderflower and grapefruit?
I think pink grapefruit and elderflower are super on-trend flavours that are going to continue to rise as well. There are a lot of people doing pink grapefruit and elderflower, but they're such refreshing, popular flavours. And I think in our range, we decided to do, you know, we've got the whole spectrum. Pink grapefruit's that slightly more bitter aftertaste, more like a gin and tonic. And then you've got the elderflower, which is slightly sweeter. So it's offering people a big flavour spectrum.
Funny enough, I prefer the grapefruit and vodka, and I think it's the addition of the cranberries, actually. The two are very nice together.
They go really well together. They really complement each other. And in the elderflower, we've got lemon, which, again, really complements the elderflower flavour.
So where can people find these? Is it a new venture of yours?
So we actually originally launched into the specialty sector with our other brand, Cold Cocktails, which we've been exhibiting for a few years now and is distributed through four different fine food distributors. So we are hoping to obviously distribute Colosa Spritz through some of these distributors and really launch into the specialty food sector. We can be found in some specialty stores already and online outlets, but we will be growing our distribution as we speak, and we're getting a lot of interest for it. Is it just because it is so on trend and what consumers are really asking for these days?
And you've already got experience because you've had these other brands, and that really helps, doesn't it, once you've learned all your lessons and gone through all that terrible, you know, learning things as you're going along. This means that you can launch this and you really know what you're doing.
Absolutely. We've definitely learned our lessons, what to do, what not to do with our first brand, and really feel like now we kind of really know what we're doing in the speciality sector and broader as well, and have really high hopes for Colosa. I think it's a fantastic product and we're really excited about selling it.
So if you want to find out about Colosa, you go on to the website, which is colosaspritz.com. And my personal favourite, pink grapefruit, Sharon?
Mine's the elderflower and gin.
There we are. That's a good 50-50 split. Thank you very much for joining us, Tori.
Thank you for having me.
And that's Tori there at a specialty and fine food fair. So we're back on the Food Talk show and we've got a good 31 minutes of Carolyn Steele. Welcome to the show, Carolyn. Now, I think it is fair to say that you are a leading thinker on food and cities. And your book, Hungry City, I know this drives you mad because it was in 2008, nearly 10 years ago, was an international bestseller. And it did describe how food shapes cities. And I think you call yourself a food urbanist, not quite sure what that is. You've taught at Cambridge University and the London School of Economics, and you're an architect and all-round brain box generally. But food is your passion and your lens, as you like to describe it.
Well, thank you for all those lovely things you just said. And actually, it doesn't drive you mad at all. I mean, in fact, I still have to pinch myself to realise that I did write a book and people actually read it. So it's wonderful to be here. And now, I mean, I think that the weird thing that I did, as it were, was to look at a city through the lens of food. And actually, it's the kind of thing that doesn't seem a very obvious thing to do until you do it. And then it seems so obvious that you wonder why you didn't do it before.
Especially in 2008. I mean, food's a real topic now, but wasn't necessarily then.
Well, that's right. And I mean, in fact, when I first had the idea in 2000, actually, and I was really just trying to humanise the urban discourse. I mean, you know, I love architects dearly and some of my best friends are architects.
But I can feel a but coming on.
There's a slight but. Actually, the but is simply that architecture itself is so complicated that there's a tendency to sort of talk endlessly about buildings, as you might imagine. You know, they're quite complicated things. And, of course, buildings are there for a reason. They're there so we can live in them, you know. But actually, there is a branch of architects who tends to think that, you know, humans kind of get in the way of the aesthetics, if you like. And I was trying to find a way of, you know, talking about architecture where actually the human was what it was really about.
What it's for. I mean,
well really. Quite. Yes. I know. And
a lot of businesses are like that. You know, we've got a business and we're running it brilliantly. Oh, we've got customers and we hate them. They're in the way. Yeah, but that's the point of you being there in the first place.
Exactly. Hmm. So I was really just trying to. I mean, I think what interested me about architecture in the first place was, you know, our relationship with buildings. You know, it's something about that thing in between that never gets talked about. And it took me, honestly, 20 years to try to find a way of talking about cities in a way that really felt sort of as I feel cities, you know. Mm. And I think we all know that if you go somewhere on holiday, your first instinct is to go to the market. You know, your first instinct is to go to the middle, see where the life is, where the action is, what everyone's doing.
Because the market is always in the middle, isn't it? Or almost.
Yes.
And that's, you know, that's where the community is.
Absolutely. Mm. Absolutely. And the reason, I mean, there are very, very powerful reasons for why it was always in the middle. a lot of markets actually predated the cities that grew around them. You know, these are places of exchange. And obviously the thing that, you know, was most important to exchange historically was food. You know, so, I mean, in Rome, for example, you know, you've got seven hills and you've got a lowland in the middle where it's obvious that people are going to meet one another and start exchanging. The Forum grows around that. The city grows around the Forum. Mm. Same in London. You know, Borough Market was a place of exchange. It's a place where it was easy to ford the River Thames, you know. So,
well, it was, yeah, and eventually it was the first bridge across London. So having a market there would make perfect sense.
Absolutely. Mm. But the market was there before the bridge.
Yes. Sorry. Know, and probably the bridge was built in order so you could get to the market better, quicker
exactly,
and better.
Yeah. Exactly. You know, so it's such a powerful thing. And also, once cities did grow around markets, then the feeding of the city itself became the problem. You know, because you've got a bunch of people who are not producing food because they're living in a city. So where is the food coming from? It's obviously coming from the countryside. You know, how does it travel into the city? And how is it bought and sold? And every city authority saw this as their greatest problem. And it was their greatest problem. You know, so the market was often the only open space in the city because, of course, cities were very compact because you had to walk everywhere. So you can't have enormous big ones. And food was the only place where you could, markets were the only place where you could get food. So everybody came to the market. And because, you know, the buying and selling of food was the most important thing going on in the city, it had to be done in the open and it had to be done under the eyes of the authority. You know, so you have the market evolving
just to make sure they can control.
Absolutely.
So, you know, so something wasn't happening that they couldn't control.
Exactly.
Or probably earn money out of.
Exactly. Of course, the irony is you can't control the food system. So, so for example, in pre-revolutionary Paris, there was a grain police headed up by the king, who was known as the Baker of Last Resort. And they you know...
That's a great term, isn't it? Baker of Last Resort.
Well, guess why he got his head chopped off?
Run out of bread.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you know, and the thing about Paris, sorry, I mean, it's all to do with geography, really. But, you know, the thing about Paris is that the Seine is not a navigable river, which means you can't import grain easily from overseas as London could, which is why Paris had to have a formal grain police, so-called, feeding the city, whereas London did not. London always took a sort of free trade attitude to feeding itself.
Because you couldn't control it anyway. Everybody's floating up and down the river.
Well, you didn't have to because you just let the free market do it. Okay. And in fact, you know, Adam Smith does a comparison between London and Paris, basically saying, well, one can obviously feed itself because it can just get the food in from anywhere, and the other is forced to have a centralised protectionist system. I mean, if you want to understand EU politics...
I was going to say, if you're looking at that now, and France is desperately trying to, you know, Macron's trying to... Every successive prime minister says that they're going to try... President, sorry, says that they're going to try and, you know, get them into a much more free market. And the culturally, that is so hard, isn't it?
Yes.
I mean, he must be the 10th one, I think, in a row that's trying to do it. Slight exaggeration. But there isn't that. And is that just to do with food? And the river? And culture and history?
You know, you underestimate the power of these historical, cultural underpinnings at your peril. I mean, they're so powerful. And I do find it really interesting that in Britain today, I mean, you know, all the politicians said, oh, you know, sort of, well, you know, of course we can just become global free trade, you know, masters
citizens,
and, you know, just get the food in. They don't understand, or they didn't really think about food at all. How are we going to feed ourselves after Brexit? And I find that really interesting because this country has, you know, the ultimate free trade attitude to food. We've always imported food from somewhere else. And, you know, how that's going to pan out in the next 50 years is going to be really interesting because the global food system that exists now is not going to look the same at all in 50 years' time. And that's a real issue.
So, Carolyn Steele, what is your prediction then? You know, you just lined yourself right up for that one. but you know, I mean, I think one of the reasons why London, for me, is one of the most exciting food cities in the world is because of that background.
Yes.
Mm. You can eat literally every cuisine in the world, I think,
absolutely.
Here, and good quality,
yes.
Actually. How's that going to pan out then, in your view?
Well, it's very interesting. I mean, when we were talking to Ben, and, you know, we were sort of saying, of course, the British are sort of, on one level, they're cautious, but on one level, there's this deep historical tradition of eating everyone else's food. You know, I think how it's going to pan out, I think there are major things that are going to provide a series of shocks to what is effectively a 200-year-old evolving industrial food system, which evolved in America in the 19th and 20th centuries and actually came, well, there's a trail from the Netherlands, actually, in the 16th and 17th centuries of very highly concentrated farming techniques that then went to Britain, was responsible for the agricultural and then industrial revolutions, and then gets exported to America and really goes large with the railways in the 19th century in America. We invented this thing called cheap food that doesn't exist by externalising the true costs of food production. And we can talk a lot more about that if you like.
How we long will have you be, got? Don't you worry.
So we've got, what industrialisation did is it created the fantasy of cheap food. We think we don't pay much for food. And in fact, if you and I go into a shop across the road now, we will pay, you know, £2 for a chicken or something, which is completely ridiculous. But of course, we are paying the true costs of that food in every other way. So, I mean, everything
particularly
from
in health, yeah, all sorts.
You name it. Yeah. I mean, you know, climate change, resource depletion, pollution, loss of fresh water, rainforest destruction, etc.
Right. Bad employment practices. You know,
the whole gig. Because the big picture is that food shapes our lives. That's the subtitle to Hungry City, and it does it in ways that we see. In other words, you know, we all know that, you know, if you're going to meet friends, of course you do it at lunch or at dinner, you know. And of course, you know that if you get too fond of the donuts, your trousers don't fit, sadly. I know whereof I speak. You know, but all the hidden stuff that we don't see shapes our lives equally powerfully. And I think that's really what I'm on a mission to do, is to get us to see that the food on your plate has, you know, it came from a landscape somewhere. And probably hundreds of people have been affected by the creation of that plate of food in front of you. And if you expand out from the plate to see the whole world, you know, everything is connected and everything is related to that plate. And so, you know, I think we need to start seeing food in a completely different way, not just as the thing that we sort of either get pleasure from when we're eating delicious things like Ben's sauces, or, you know, we're just fueling ourselves because we're too busy. I mean, you know, the Soylent phenomenon, if you like, sure. If you've dealt with that on the programme, you know, too busy to eat, so we're just going to stick sludge down our throats and carry on with something more important, which I find really fascinating. You know, it's actually about the whole world seen through the lens of food, and to understand that, you know, everything from our landscapes and our cities to our bodies to our habits to our, you know, the way we socialise, our political structures, our economic structures. Yeah, I mean, honestly, everything
food.
Is shaped through food.
Well, do you think, though, there is the beginnings of an awakening in this area?
Very much so. Very much so.
What do you see as being the things, apart from your book, that's triggering this this awakening?
Yes, I don't take sole responsibility for the global awakening about food, don't worry. Well, you know, it's very interesting. I would say that the Plan B, or the counter movement, began in the States in the 1970s. Why is that? Because the States, as I say, was the sort of the place where modern industrial food was invented. You know, it really went big. And it was around about the 1970s that people began to go, oh, hang on, do I really want my cows to be the size of a bus and pumped full of hormones and antibiotics and, you know, so full of milk they can't walk? Or do I really want all my bread to be so full of sugar that, you know, basically my teeth fall out if I have a bite of it? No, probably not. And there's a bunch of people in the States, such as Alice Waters and Wendell Berry and the people who set up the Brooklyn Food Co-op, for example, who just said, look, this is wrong. We can't feed ourselves in this way. And they began what we would now call the new food movement, or just the food movement, which is the absolute antithesis to the industrial model, who basically say food is the most important thing in our lives. It can't be cheap, you know, because actually food is life. And therefore, if you don't value food, you don't value life. And this is something I'm arguing in my new book. And therefore, OK, what does the world look like if you treat food as a really valuable thing? Well,
as opposed to a cheap throwaway thing.
Exactly. And it looks totally different. I mean, in fact, you know, I have a sort of proposal, which I haven't quite dotted the I's on and crossed the T's on, but essentially, I call it Zootopian economics, and I'd have to explain what Zootopia is in order for people to understand what that is. But Zootopia is just a word I've invented. It's from the Greek word sitos, which means food, and topos, which means place. And it's a kind of alternative to utopia, if you like, which just means a good place, but also no place. Because I believe we live in Zootopia, in other words, a world shaped by food. but we don't really see it. We don't understand it, and so we live in a bad Sitopia. Because, you know, a bad Sitopia is one where food is treated as if it's cheap.
And will always be there.
Yeah.
You know, is just everlasting.
You can't escape Sitopia if you're human, because we eat, and the fact that we need to eat shapes everything.
But we just assume the food supply is going to be there and continuing, aren't we?
Yes. Well, I mean, industrialisation has given us that illusion.
Yeah.
You know, so, I mean, if you live in London and you're, say, 25 years old, you've never shopped anywhere but Tesco, you know, you walk in and the shelves are always heaving with goodness knows what, then of course you're going to assume
with 100 choices of orange juice.
100 choices of orange juice, yeah, as it turns out, but probably no orange juice that has as much nutrition in as orange juice would have done 50 years ago, because industrial production actually reduces nutritional content of food. So, I mean, it's a very, very interesting place that we're in. Food appears to be ubiquitous and, you know, just we've solved the problem, if you like. And actually, the reality is completely the opposite, to come back to the question you asked me probably 10 minutes ago about, you know, what is the food system going to look like in 50 years' time? And the really interesting thing is that the industrial system that we rely on, and which has given us this illusion that we've solved the problem of feeding ourselves, as it were, is about to hit the buffers in so many ways you just, you know, you can't count them on the fingers and toes of two hands and 2 feet.
I mean that's quite frightening, really. I mean, if we just go back a bit to your book for people who don't know about it.
Yes.
The Hungry City. I came across you by actually watching your TED talk, which again was quite a long time ago now. I think it was 10 years ago.
Everything's twice as long ago as you think. That's,
I know,
my theory of time.
You know, and a million people have watched that. So it is hugely influential. And I know you're very modest, but it is influential. But the point of the Hungry City for me is explaining how we've got to where we are and how cities have been shaped in the way they have. You know, like you've been talking about Paris versus London. But you know, there's almost a line that you've drawn there. You know, this is where we are. And then you've said there are these things on the horizon that I'm a little bit worried about. And that was in 2008. Your new book, are you taking that as your sort of, you know, benchmark, if you like, or your watershed or whatever, and going, right, now I'm I know it's taking you a long time to write and it's driving you mad, because I'm in a, you know, I write books as well, and it drives you mad. But you know, you're clearly very passionate about it, but it is something you're very worried about, isn't it? You are really worried about it, and you're trying to get people to understand that all this stuff is an illusion.
Yes. I mean, I think for me the most important realisation that I've had is that food is life. And you can argue that, I mean, food is an amazing metaphor for life. I mean, food is living things that we kill in order to live. So there's a deep, deep, profound ethical meaning.
And that can be plants as well as animals, of course.
Oh, totally.
Yeah.
Well, it's all plants.
Yes.
Because if we eat the animals, they're eating plants first.
But somebody might be listening to that thinking that it's okay because I'm a vegetarian.
Oh,
it doesn't work like that.
No, I'm afraid plants are living too. So, you know, you have an ethical scale, if you like. You know, what do you give yourself permission to eat? And it's very interesting, the Jains, you know, this kind of very pure sect of religious people in India, they don't see human life as more valuable than any other kind of life, you know. And that makes eating pretty much impossible, because how do you give yourself permission, as it were?
You could eat your neighbour, couldn't you? No difference from eating a beetroot. I'm being flippant, sorry.
No, but it's a very interesting, and we should definitely debate that. I mean, that, you know, that's a very good point. Cannibalism and Jainism as two naturally logical...
But my point is it's no different to them, possibly.
Yeah, well, that's right. I mean, it's very interesting. I mean, they go to... The very, very devout Jains won't eat, for example, anything that's grown in the ground, because, you know, the microbes that might stick to your potato or something would be killed when you eat it. So it makes, as I say, the dilemma of eating nearly impossible. In fact, they allow themselves to eat fruit that's dropped off a tree, because, you know, that kind of means the tree doesn't need it anymore, so it's okay to eat. So it's a really interesting position. If you look at the Western position, as inherited by the Bible, you might say, I mean, you know, sort of Genesis, sort of chapter 1, verse 2, more or less, is, you know, okay, humans, you're in charge of the earth, you know, go forth and multiply and look after all the plants and animals, and that kind of they're yours to eat. I mean, it's a bit more complicated than that, because actually Adam and Eve are vegetarian, and it's only after the fall that they start becoming farmers and eating meat. So that's very interesting as well. But in essence, you know, we see human life as more important than any other life in Western civilization. And this means that the whole of the world is a free lunch, essentially. And of course, we've got now got, and there always have been, by the way, counter reactions to this position. But, you know, the sort of the omnivorous, you know, king of the universe view of what it's OK to eat is really what drives industrial food production, for example. And the idea that, you know, we don't have to think about food. Which is an astonishing ethical position when you think about
it. An astonishingly arrogant position.
Absolutely.
As well.
Yes. Yeah.
In some ways, human beings are incredible in that they are total omnivores. I mean, they literally... And human beings, unlike any other animal, have the ability to keep eating something that they don't like until they like it.
Yes.
Well, no other animal
does
that.
Unless it's kids with broccoli, in which case you might have a bit of a challenge. But yes.
That's where ketchup comes in.
But exactly. But no, and it's absolutely essential to our success. Mm. I mean, if we weren't that adaptable and we weren't omnivorous, we wouldn't have taken over the planet. Yeah. You know, so it's fundamental to our success. And I think the ethical position we find ourselves in now is really, really interesting. We have the power to destroy the planet. We're in the process of doing it. You know, at what point do we decide, OK, we're going to go to plan B, we're not going to exercise our power? You know, and I think how we eat plays into this really, really interestingly, because actually how we eat is a direct reflection on the extent to which we give ourselves permission to have dominion over other animals, dominion over nature, etc., in order to keep ourselves alive. And actually, you know, it seems to me that a logical and acceptable ethical position would be to say that the only, as it were, really okay way to feed ourselves is a way to feed ourselves that allows us, plus all the other living things on the planet, to live well.
To coexist.
And then you have to decide what living well means, which gets also interesting. Mm. But it's a way of eating and producing food that is good for the planet as well for us. And that looks absolutely nothing like industrial farming.
No.
And it looks absolutely nothing, I'm afraid, like the average way that, you know,
most people eat,
shall we say, an average Londoner would get through a week.
But are you optimistic? Do you feel it's at a tipping point? I do think we have so many people on this show who are doing really amazing things,
yes,
and are very, you know, really striving, although it's quite difficult, really striving to produce food that they feel is ethical in a particular way, you know, and source it and be local and do the, you know, all those things. And they're trying to do battle against the big industrial companies. I have to tell you, I have some sympathy with the big industrialists because actually they are being pushed by the public to have cheap food, and there's loads of pressure to have cheap food. And somebody's got to supply cheap food because nobody's...
That's right.
None of us want to pay,
you
know, the right amount.
Yes. And I mean, none of this is straightforward. And
no,
agree.
It's not straightforward. And I don't
all
think
industrialists
it's,
are evil.
And I don't think it's about baddies and goodies. No. I think people are being driven in the system to cut corners because it's impossible to deliver cheap food.
Yes.
It is a mirage.
But now you're opening up...
Do you think do you think we are at a tipping point?
To answer all of your questions in turn, yes, I am I am optimistic. I think humans are best in a crisis, weirdly, and that's just one of those bizarre paradoxes. I think we're heading for a major, major crisis, and I think we've got to completely reassess not only how we feed ourselves, but actually how we live. And that's a good thing because actually industrialization
will respond,
plus capitalism is destroying the planet at the moment, and I don't think it's actually delivering good life either. And I'm not saying that industrialization and capitalism together, if modified, seriously modified, can't deliver a good life for everyone, but you know, at the moment that's not what the system delivers, so we have to really rethink how we use the instrument of a market, what its relationship is with the state, and actually most importantly of all, what our conception of a good life is. Because if it's...
And quality of life.
Yes, I mean a good life in every sense. So yeah, I mean ethically sort of, you know, okay, plus good, fun,
healthily
pleasurable,
okay,
joyful,
pleasurable,
lovely.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah.
And, you know, in a way, I think what we've lost, and here is where food is such an important element of this, is the joy and pleasure that can be derived out of eating well. And historically, eating well was the core of a good life. And the irony of industrialization is it's that absolute core that it's destroyed. You know, so we're now too busy to eat. I mean, how bizarre is that?
Well, you didn't have any breakfast this morning, Ollie, did you?
No, I did. I had something that was heavily industrially produced.
No, but what I'm saying is that because there's pressure on your life, you've got young children, you've got to get out the door, you know, there's all these things happening to you, and you know, it's all wrong, isn't it?
Really? Yeah, but the truth is, I think the interesting question in some ways is how the individual responds to this stuff, because there are two different, there are lots of levels you can have this conversation, but one level is about the kind of, okay, how is society reorganized and restructured, which is kind of beyond a lot of people's pay grade, I will say. and actually when I ask the question, which is, so what am I supposed to do?
I think this is,
you know, I think with all the political turmoil and chaos we've had, you know, here and other parts of the world over the last few years, I think everyone is kind of asking the question, what am I supposed to do? And I think the difficulty with the whole, you know, driving to the bottom on prices, it's not just food, you know, it's fashion.
Absolutely everything.
It's transportation. It's everything. Yes. So we're all looking, we're also saying, well, why should I value X and why and how do I put monetary value on it? And we've been kind of taught, you know, and you can point lots of fingers, that cheap is good. You know, and in the Americas, this world, it's the Walmarts that have done it.
Yes.
And, you know, there are lots of supermarkets here that have championed it. And I'm always amazed at how it is across the economic spectrum. You know, we were talking to Monica from Brindisi the other day, who sells, you know, 700-800 pound legs of ham on, which are beautifully, take 5-6 years to create. And then at the other end of the spectrum, you've got the £20 one that comes from Lidl.
Yes.
And the problem is there are these spectrums, and I think people are kind of, they're drawn into that cheap solution because it looks shiny and interesting and attainable.
No, but the illusion for me is that somebody thinks that's a bargain. That somehow it's still a £700 one, but they've managed to, I don't know, take a hit on it, or it's a loss leader, so you go in the supermarket. And I think they con themselves into thinking it's still produced in the same way as a good one. And you know what? A lot of people are happy to do that.
But they don't see the economic impact, do they?
No. I won't shop in Primark or any of those because you cannot have, I'm really sorry, but you cannot have cheap clothes without somebody suffering down the end of the line. And you can hide that as much as you want, but I know it's impossible to do that. But other people go, well, no, it's the normal way that you produce something else, it's just that they managed to get it cheaper. No, well, they haven't, you know.
No. And I mean, I think,
and it is an illusion.
It is the absolute basis of capitalism. This is the, I mean, you know, you go back to Adam Smith and his pin factory. You know, basically, one bloke making pins can make 10 pins a day, but 10 blokes making one stage of the pins journey can make, you know, 10,000 pins a day. So through efficiency, you create cheapness. But actually, the one bloke making the pins was having a better life.
I was going to say, make your life completely miserable by doing that one thing 1,000 times a day.
And E.F. Schumacher, who's, you know, I mean, it was also part, by the way, of the 1970s counter-revolution. He's just in economics rather than food. But he brilliantly analysed this, and he said the problem with capitalism is that we separate man the producer and man the consumer and pretend they're two different people. So if you took, you know, a Rolls Royce to work in order to sort of put peas in a can, that would be seen as a ridiculously inefficient way of producing the peas. But if you made enough profit from canning the peas that you could afford to take a Rolls Royce to the theatre in the evening, that would be seen as a massive success. But it's the same bloke, you know, theoretically, who's doing the work and having the fun. You know, in other words, we have to put these two things together again, which means we need a revolution in the world of work.
Sure, but you're not anti-capitalist in this respect, because I don't think we can survive without that type of, you know, structure. It just has to be a much more moral and ethical and inclusive version of what we currently have.
We need a new economics, and I was going to... You know, I'm not anti-capitalist, but I am anti the form of capitalism we've got at the moment, which is neoliberal capitalism, which is basically the idea that the market can decide everything, and there's a deep history to this. And it's anti-state, and I think it's disastrous. So my answer, by the way, I was going to explain Sitopia, which I explained earlier.
Indeed.
My answer is Sitopian economics. Sitopian economics is basically the internalisation of the true cost of food. Now, you could do that...
Internalisation, you know, in terms of at an individual level?
No, I mean actually institutionalised. So, for example, if we're paying money... you know, I mean, well, you mentioned earlier obesity and type 2 diabetes and all these diet-related diseases. You know, so sugar is costing us money, pollution is costing us money, climate change is costing us money.
Yeah, the state understands that when it's smoking, but they don't understand it when it's to do with food.
They understand it, but they're terrified of going near it because politicians hate going near food, going back to Louis XVI losing his head for failing to feed Paris. Politicians are terrified of food, for good reason.
Is that why? I mean, I am appalled at the government taking no step in food at the moment. You know, and Jamie Oliver banging down the door with Theresa May saying, can we do this? And then it's just shelved. Now, I do understand that politicians have a lot on their plate. Ha ha, do you like that one? But it is so important. We've got a whole bunch of kids growing up, can't cook, can't buy food, understand it, you know. And surely that can't be right.
But is it, I mean, is our failure that we look to politicians to lead this change? Is it not that we have to somehow in our own little way try and take that change on? I mean, I understand that, you know, it's a hell of a lot quicker if you can say, right, sugar tax on soft drinks.
But I don't think it should be a tax. I think if you incentivise corporates as opposed to penalise them, instead of them looking for a get-out-of-jail-free card, they'll actually do something positive because actually at the end of the day they'll make more profit or they'll do whatever. And we always seem to punish people as opposed to look at corporates and how can we incentivise them to do the right behaviours, which is a better way around.
Yeah. I mean, it's not an either-or. I mean, and to go back to your earlier point, Ollie, I mean, of course, as individuals, we can do a huge amount. We can eat better food. We can, you know, pay producers to do it right.
Use my personal spending power to make those decisions, but I'm in a lucky position that I can do that.
Exactly. But we need political involvement as well. Mm. It can't just be grassroots movements. And we need to wean politicians off this idea that basically they can leave food to the industry. Because I'm afraid you get, you know...
Well, and the reason for that is it's not a free industry anymore. You know, you were describing, and I'm really sorry, I'm going to have to finish this programme in a minute, but you were describing, you know, my vision is people sailing up the Thames with their bag of whatever it is to go and sell in the markets because it really was a free market. Mm. It's not a free market now because there are a handful of corporates who actually control it.
That's right.
And for you, that's the issue.
That's right. And I think we've got to break down that monopoly. I mean, food systems and societies mirror one another. So if you can't have a democracy if you've got a monopolistic food system. It just absolutely stands to reason. Mm. So you've got to deal with it.
We could go on talking. Should we just talk after the programme's finished? Can we carry on? Should we do that? Carolyn Steele is author of The Hungry City, How Food Shapes Our Lives. Definitely go and if you're interested in that, you know, have a good read. Or you can see her on the lovely TED Talk, which is very inspiring. Your new book, when's that coming? I'm going to put you on the spot because it'll make you finish it now.
No, and then your publisher
will be so pleased with me for putting you under pressure.
I'm really hoping to have it out in January 2019.
Oh my goodness.
That involves me not having a Christmas.
Oh, okay.
Which would be sad, but I'm desperate to get it out.
I think with all your incredible, just your incredible knowledge, there'll be a lot of people who'll be very interested in what you've got to say. I'll definitely be looking out for that. I don't really want to finish, but you've listened to the Food Talk show. We're now syndicated across dozens of radio stations across the UK and further afield from California to the Kent Coast, Manchester to Michigan and even Malta. Thank you to my fellow presenter, Ollie. That was really interesting, wasn't it, Ollie?
You're welcome. I love the way we always say even Malta. Malta is my father-in-law's base.
There you go.
Makes me laugh.
Including Malta is what I should be saying. If you want to comment on anything Carolyn said or you know, you've got some of your own thoughts, you know, please contact us via Twitter on @foodtalkshow. And if you want to listen to hundreds of our podcasts, just go on to foodtalk.co.uk. We're getting an increasingly great repository of fantastic guests, so check that out. Thanks again to Carolyn Steele. Have a good week. Bye.